most people are giving up on an idea before an idea's got a chance to be able to reach maturity. And when you produce a piece of work that is so distilled, you can then do so much more with it.
I think it's hard for people to understand, at the highest level, you don't pay for so much time, you pay for their expertise. And then when we make that shift in life, it changes everything.
We still live in a world where people want to tell people what to do because it matters to me. I can tell you what I think you should do, Erwin, for as long as I've got air in my lungs, and you will not connect with that until you decide it matters to you. We live in an advice-driven world where people believe that your advice is the gift. No, the gift is created by somebody saying, I value your advice.
I think the goal would be to build a community where speakers feel so comfortable they want to come back.
Yep.
And give people who speak in primarily corporate spaces, or you know, to teams, an opportunity where the people that they can connect with on a local level.
Yeah. I'm part of a community that we run up in Toronto each year in Canada. It's called Epic. Circa 100 people, same group of people come, but on the speaker side of things, some of us are faculty, and we were part of the founding piece, and then some of it is new faces. So it's about half and half. There's six of us that are the same recurring and have to come up with new material every year. And
Aaron had that same thought for ours, that we should have some people with anchor. I just didn't know. It's always hard when you go to your friends, are you willing to do this every year?
You know. Well, I think what it does is, I mean, again, just like any tenure, you can be faculty for a period and you can peace out at a point. But what you then end up getting is you get value of being a participant at that event. So what I do up in Epic, I give 4 days a year, and it's at the Ritz-Carlton in Toronto. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I enjoy my contribution, but I enjoy also the reset time. It's every December. It's a chance to be able to look at,
And then are the 100 people the same people? Or do they cap that event?
It's a capped at 100 event, but you know, there might be 20, 25 new and 70, 75 the same.
Okay.
I think like anything, right? Some people drop out, create space for some new to come in, but it has an energy of being the same, and you get, like, from a community point of view, once a year is actually still fairly frequent for a lot of people.
For a 20-year period or so, I was a part of some of the more influential, like, secular spaces with, like, TED and Pop Tech and Renaissance, and there are four of them that were like the TED conference.
Yep.
But everybody knows TED.
Right.
You know, but like Pop Tech is in Connecticut, and it's where TED would get their speakers.
Okay.
You know, and so they would always be bitter toward TED because they would find the speakers and then TED would make them famous.
Okay. Yeah, got it.
And then Renaissance was TED, but more hippie.
Okay.
Like all the more like Richard Branson feeling billionaires, very hippie, very, you know.
Back in the day though, right?
Yeah. This was just over a you know, 20 years. And one of the things I realized is that those spaces were great, but they kind of lost their edge.
Yep.
You know, like TED became very much an environmentalist space.
Right.
And it wasn't like that when we started, you know, and it was so unique and so diverse and actually really fun, you know. And after that, it just felt like it was like one or two agenda kind of thing.
Yeah, getting a political agenda, starting to be able to feel like work.
Once it became TED Talks,
they
only started filming for the world rather than for us. You know, so I actually think that we can take that space that is really, I think, is blue ocean now.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm excited.
So I'm hoping we can kind of build something that would have.
I think you got something. Broad. Yeah, I think it definitely has it.
Yeah, and thank you for being part of the founding.
Yeah.
Fathers of Fest. Honestly, you were amazing. We were just talking about it, and I don't know you at all, and that's hopefully we can change that today, but it was just such a gift that you spent so much time with us.
Thank you.
And I remember I knew you were coming and I knew what your face looked like, but then seeing you at his house, it was so surprising to me. And you're like, "Hey, I'm Phil." And I was like, "Hi, why are you here?"
That's it. Well, and even I got the invite.
Though I have 11, if you want to come back, I literally didn't speak. I was supposed to speak twice and I just cut myself.
Right. No, and just thank you. Thank you for being so generous with your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Not sure if you knew you were getting roped into that, but I appreciate it.
I'm a kind of person, if I say yes to something, it's like a full yes. It's not a part yes.
Yeah.
And you don't know what you're a part of until you get to be able to play along. And in those environments, the last thing you want is to just show up and do your thing and then disappear again. And I've seen that happen way too many times. You're trying to create something with a heart and energy, and you invite people that have some external posture, and they just show up and they play their greatest hits and then do one. And they're not really even sure who they're performing for. It's like a musician that doesn't know their audience and wonders why it didn't land.
It's interesting.
I'm really hoping that it comes together with the GSL.
Yes.
And they're very close to me.
Yeah.
You know, and so
yeah, that'll be fun. I'd enjoy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked to them before, and then we talked to them after, and I talked to them about you. And they've really, really enjoyed you tremendously.
Yeah, we've had a little text back and forth, and they're talking 24 or 25. So we'll
they're see. Very deliberative, like very cautious.
Cool.
In the way that they work.
I would just say they're really planned. You know, they like to plan. And
it's fine.
They think we're crazy, which I love. And they really yeah. like us. And so we jumped on a Zoom call maybe the 5 weeks before we did the arena. And I was like, oh, here's, you know, if you want to come. And here's the roster. And they were like, this is better than what we have this year. And except for your dad, you know, your dad's coming to us. And I was like, oh, amazing. Well, you should come. And yeah. and if they're great. They're good.
Well,
good
and I think people. That's the example of the power of community, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody can wave a checkbook around and put a good roster together, but you don't yeah. create a cohesive event without it yeah. having a through line of friendship or connection.
It's yeah. so true, right?
Yeah, so they even through the pandemic stuff, they would text me and just say, you know, hey, we're just kind of watching who you bring on your podcast.
Yeah.
That's who we're inviting. That's how they found Jamie. That's how, yep. you know.
Well, and it's nice that we're sat backstage as well, and you got like me and John and yeah. Todd just jamming. Like, what do we bring to today that's different yeah. than what you normally yeah. would do? Like, there's a level of everybody up in their game a little because mm-hmm. they care about it because of you and like unusual stakes. It's not the stakes of a corporate client event. It's yeah. a different energy from a performance point of view.
It is. And one of the things we're going to try to do is do these like one day things mm-hmm. where we can see if we can build an audience just for it can even be online.
I think that like the whole idea, we want to play with this idea of the arena
yep.
of being yeah. like gladiators and having these different ideas. And I think you were trying to play with that a little bit with Todd Herman and John Gordon with Alter Ego. And
they just didn't spark.
No, it didn't.
The way
no,
I wanted
play up
so,
the way. Yeah.
No. But so I think creating these like one evening summits, these 2 hour events where
right.
people can access them online. And so that's
so I'd love to do one with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And we can you know, get scrappy with it in a way yeah. that's like,
just have fun. Like, you know, it's.
Well, your kind of fun is different than most people. Kind of I was telling him today, he was like, oh, we should just do Between Two Ferns with Phil and roast him. And I was like, that's not fun for anyone except for you. I like friends and I like people and no.
Yeah, I don't know. That would get tricky for both of us. But it would be fun, actually.
You would never do it with someone that you felt could not fight their way out of it.
But you I understand now why you've always used the metaphor of like, what is it? Whales play killer whales.
Oh, killer whales play with seals.
With their food before they kill them. That is you. You're the killer whale, and everyone else are the seals. And I don't like that. I'm gonna put you in SeaWorld.
Yeah.
No.
So one day meets a shark, right?
Yeah. One day meets a shark. Yeah.
No, it's only fun if a person really is witty.
Yes.
And you are witty.
Yeah, we can jam on it.
You know. All right, lately we probably.
How long are we planning a run for? Who do you imagine is the other side of this conversation?
Yeah, no one's listening, Phil.
It's fine. Well, it's like most podcasting. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think.
It's just us. We're just having recording it for archive purposes. No.
How long do you have?
As long as you need.
Okay. I think we usually run about 50 minutes to like an hour and 10.
That's great.
And it's really, we just kind of roll with it.
Yeah, it works so awesome. I got my afternoon clear and my wife is actually in Soho taking a class with a friend. And okay. when I'm done from here, I'm going to meet my wife for brunch before we pick the kids up. So
amazing. We're going to brunch. Perfect. Where do you guys
go? She's just going to choose somewhere and tell me where to meet. It's even better.
Perfect.
Yeah. And the really cool thing about the Mindshift podcast is that we've actually already started.
Good.
Good. It's good.
This is where we start.
Perfect.
Yeah, there is no beginning. There is no just, beginning or end.
It just runs.
It just runs. But I think the people on the other side, I think a bit of it is we're definitely like obtaining a new audience. So it's you know, in the past it was primarily like just a father and son conversation around like life, spirituality, and humanity. And now it's kind of, and then for a season we did politics, and then we quickly hated ourselves and everyone around us, and mostly just the life that brings. Like
yeah.
no
yeah.
wonder these people are so depressed when they talk about politics all the time.
Yeah, you so got we got miserable creating a show.
So we quickly got out of that.
That was the pandemic era.
That was okay. the pandemic.
But during the era. Pandemic, we really, I think. Had a really important conversation because people felt very isolated and alone. And I think that was an important season for Battle Ready at that time. And then we shifted it to Mindshift.
Mindshift.
We have a lot of entrepreneurs who are joining us, a lot of people who I would think would self-identify themselves as outliers.
Right.
You know, more pioneers, more innovative,
yep.
more...
And it's a lonely journey, right?
Yeah,
and finding somebody else can help uncover some of the thoughts that exist in their mind out yeah. loud and realize they're not as alone as they thought they were.
Yeah. So this isn't really an audience of people that you would consider always mainstream.
Right.
You know, and even the ones who are mainstream in terms of the world they live in, they don't fit. And so they're always trying to figure out how to make the greatest impact in the world that they live in.
Got it.
So it's a really great audience because they act on what you bring to them.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I just thought it'd be really good just to one to introduce you to mm-hmm. the audience and get some of your backstory. You know, you're clearly from not from around here.
I'm not from New York City. No, I grew up on the outskirts of London.
Wow. So give us a little bit your backstory. What your childhood? What it was like?
I mean, my childhood is largely fantastic. I'm one of four kids. Very much working class family. My dad's been self-employed his whole life. Mum and dad were married 19 and 17. I'm middle boy, so I'm like the black sheep of the family, and older brother is the golden child, followed university, got teaching degree and went on and been a fantastic school teacher. My sister had a background in nursing, and then my younger brother has stepped into military service and then later gone on to be able to follow into my dad's small building construction business. And mm-hmm. here's me, black sheep, like blasting out from there. But I've been entrepreneurial and wanting to move my life forward and my business forward, not because there was anything wrong with the way that I grew up. I just saw the world as a bigger place. I got the gift of joining a youth leadership program when I was in my sort of mid to late teens, got to travel to India, got to do some philanthropic projects, got to start to see that the world was bigger, the world was broader, met a few people that were doing really interesting things to me. And it made me go like, my world went from this big to this big overnight. And parents did a great job, got me into a great school, but I was the poor kid at the school. Like, I didn't have the sneakers, didn't have the clothes, didn't have the backpack, didn't have the jacket. And as much as everybody was there to provide for me, I learned I needed to provide for myself. And what I did have is the love of my family. So I was the only kid at school that had a packed lunch. Everybody else got money. So what I did is I turned my packed lunch into money. I sold the sandwiches my mum made me. Got enough to buy myself a hot lunch and have some change to be able to do more. So I was always looking to trade up and started first real business when I was 14. Started knocking on the doors of my neighbors, asking them if they wanted their cars washed. By the age of 15, I had a fairly prolific small business. We was making more money than my school teachers, had kids in the year below that were delivering much of the work, and was running a little empire that was making me what many would call a real income today.
So how many employees did you have?
Not employees as such, but I guess I had
private contractors.
Yeah, 7, 8, 9. I didn't even know what I had, right? I had more clients than I could service. So I'd say like, Chris, you do that one, and Harvey, you do this one, and I'd run a little notebook of who needed what, and when we finished, I'd say, well, you know, how soon do you want us to come back for next time? And very much bucket sponge, chamois leather, mm-hmm. car shampoo, and
that's amazing.
And I'd pay the people that did the car half the money that the client paid and collect the difference. And
yeah,
it was. So how quickly did you go from washing cars to not washing cars, but still having other people?
About 4 months,
right?
No, yeah, no, that, pretty quick.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, right? Yeah. So now you're having other people do what you were doing.
That's it,
and still getting paid for it.
I built businesses through my youth like we'd run events. Mm-hmm. Under 18s wanted to be able to go out and have fun, and you know, I'd hire a nightclub venue on a Tuesday and have it from 6 till 9 p.m. and get 200 kids together for a party that they'd all pay for tickets. There'll be no alcohol. Mm-hmm. Will be fun. So collaborated with friends at school to do those things. And my mum worked at a garden center, so I got access to discounted plants. So I started a little landscaping business and mm-hmm. made money on that, and was very much looking at ways that I could add value to something I had access to and generate some extra income to level up life. And then I had an offer for a good university. I didn't want to go. Didn't want to take that traditional route of getting a piece of paper and growing my education that way. So I got thrown in at the deep end by applying for a graduate training program for a big department store retail company that were really good and prolific at their training. It's like how they trained young people into leadership and management roles and sales leadership roles. And I applied for their grad training program. I just didn't tell them I didn't have a degree, and nobody
from
asked
high
me.
School
yeah okay. Went straight in at 18. I didn't tell them. They didn't ask.
Did they ever figure it out?
No, it never became an issue. It just
That's amazing.
And it was through assessment centers and multiple steps in interviews and recruitment. And
you passed.
Yeah, I got through to finals and then got put into a position where I was like in a mentor relationship in a department store just outside London. And then my mentor went off long-term sick, literally 10 days after I started in the role. And I got thrown at the deep end and was one of the youngest ever sales managers in that organization without mentorship and without leadership. So I had to go looking for it. Had the aspiration of being geographically mobile. I did 11 stores for that organization in about a 5-year window.
All around London?
All across the UK. So I'd go anywhere. Wow. If there was a promotion opportunity, new store opening, turnaround project, like I was the kid that said yes and then found out what it was that I'm supposed to do next. And I think that allowed me to fast track a career, get a lot of experience in a short period of time. And what's great about going from new environment of leadership to new environment, leadership to new environment, is every time you make that shift, you can reinvent. Like you take all the good stuff and you leave the bad stuff away. You take the good stuff and you leave the bad stuff behind. And reputationally speaking, none of us are perfect. But if you get the chance to be able to shed what was not good and show up better and do that on rinse, repeat, go 3-4 years, you've completely reinvented yourself without any of the baggage of old. And I really enjoyed that belief of growth of saying, how do I keep crafting and creating a better version of self, leaving parts behind, and hit a glass ceiling there and got approached by a furniture retail company and helped them in project turnarounds, did a very similar thing there, got approached by the world of professional soccer, was head of retail commercial director for 2 Premier League soccer clubs. And
how old were you at this time?
Mid-20s.
Okay.
Client in that environment then approached me about starting a real estate investing business, selling homes in Cyprus to UK investors, and wanted to scale that business, build a sales team and grow that to a bigger business, and invited me to come and be a business partner, head up that operation. And we did really well there till about 2008.
Bad year.
And then that world changed, right? We had a great product. We had secured fantastic lending. The criteria against it was awesome. The equity and the investments we had, like we had a really good time for a good time. And then the game changed, like, literally in a 7-day window. So we bought that business down. That was one of the hardest struggles and negotiations. You know, you try and hold on to a belief, even though the market's telling you that it's wrong. And then probably the hardest sales job I had in my life was bringing that company down and making sure that all the real people that had invested in what we'd shared with them actually got keys, actually got their money to a point of safety. And we had cool projects that were bank guaranteed, which sounded like a good thing, other than these were Greek banks. Greek banks in 2008, their guarantee was like, I mean, this coffee cup was worth more.
they disappeared.
So that was
went to Greece during that season, and everything was cash.
Right.
Nothing was going to banks. Nothing was going to government at all.
And we had this also coincided with Greek banks. Cypriot pound was still the primary currency, and a shift into euro at the exact same time. So all that happened is, anybody who had any wealth would only trade in cash because they didn't trust the currency transfer, they didn't trust the banks, they didn't trust anything else, and it became a like an insular economy outside of anything environmental. So that was interesting time, and and wondering what I wanted to do next is I'd built many of those business relationships through business networking, so BNI chapters and local chambers of commerce, and those environments knew me as being both optimistic and having ideas that people could use to create something out of nothing, or to develop new client relationships or get paid more. And they would invite me to come in and speak to their members, talk about ideas that they could trade out of recession. Independent business owners like plumbers and carpenters and insurance agents and salons and personal trainers. And I started doing that for fun while I figured out what I wanted to do next. That was 2008. And then I've built this business very much from those very humble beginnings. It then became people saying, can you do more? I'm saying, like, I got more than 30 minutes for sure. And they're like, could you run a full day? And I'm said, yeah, sure. And I think I put my first one day training out there maybe late 2008, early 2009. Goal was to put 12 independent business owners in a room, charge them £85 a head, with a aspiration of maybe a coaching or a consulting business off the back of that. And people would ask me the question, will it cover this? when I was prospecting to try and get people in the room. Mm. And yeah, I'd say, yeah, we'll cover that.
Definitely cover that.
Write that down.
I just had a call like that this week.
That's right. Can you talk about blank? Yeah, absolutely. That's in the program.
We got that. That's right. Exactly what I was thinking.
built that one-day program, and it's just kept riding on from there. And, mm-hmm. and you know, now I've had the gift of being able to speak in 59 different countries and being paid to present more than 3,500 times, written 11 books. And almost what's interestingly and unique in my world is it's all self-taught, all self-written, all self-graded, and no external financial backing. So no publisher has backed a book, but we've sold 2.7 million copies of a self-published book. And no agency has grabbed us and run with it. It's all been, everybody else has said no, but I've said yes and just said, let's figure it out.
Wait, hold on. How many copies of self-published?
2.7 million.
We're self-publishing. Not that that's the answer. We're self-publishing. That's so yeah. Okay.
And I make $4 or $5 of a book that sells on Amazon.
Wow.
So it's a different revenue model for sure.
That's great math. That's like fantastic math.
That's it. It's not bad, right?
No, it's not bad. Yeah. What brought that decision to self-publish? And what is the business now? You kind of have alluded to it. But.
I mean, the business is weird. It's like 40 odd independent revenue streams that all overlap through one common denominator, which is me. The decision around self-publishing firstly became is that I didn't really have an alternative option. Yeah. Is nobody else was saying yes. So and the same is like I never got booked to speak, so I ran my own events and booked myself to speak. I didn't have a publisher that said, like, here's a check for you to write a book. Mm-hmm. So backed myself. And even my very first book, Toolbox, I sold 2,000 copies of the book before I wrote it.
So how'd you do that?
Network, going back to past clients, and look at the greatest of entrepreneurs that exist today is like Elon Musk has secured how many orders for a truck that had one being built just as a prototype?
Yeah.
I watched the BlackBerry movie the other day and you know, BlackBerry got the buy-in for people to be able to lean forward with that phone when it was nothing more than a hodgepodge of parts together and a dream and an idea. And I think many people believe you have to build it and then find people who want to buy it. My belief is you need to sell it and then be able to deliver or over deliver to the promise. So that's
where'd that come from? Can I dig in a little bit?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm hopelessly optimistic. I think there's a part of that, and I believe that to win the game you got to play the game. So sometimes you just got to roll the dice, and I also believe that if you don't believe in yourself, how can you expect somebody else to believe in you? So many people are looking for another person to validate them being competent or capable or having, you know, they're looking for external permission to soar or grow or strive, whatever that might mean to them. And that drives me crazy is like the first person has to decide this is going to work is you, not somebody else. So that's always lived in me. And I believe that if somebody else can do it, can somebody else be me? And that's a question.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes the answer is no, right? If somebody else can do it, as in like slam dunk a hoop on a basketball court, the answer is yes. Can that person be me? Probably not. So sometimes you find the answer is no, but sometimes you find the answer is maybe or heck yes. And that I find quite empowering. I like control and I like creativity. And what I've learned to be true is when you work with people around the creativity of your idea or the uniqueness of your own body of work. And the book space is a really easy one to look at with this is the other people don't care about it like you do. They don't understand it like you do. They're not going to live with it like you are. Like, I'll do interviews this week around my brand new book called Exactly What to Say that I published in 2017.
I like
just
how you
catch
said that,
right? My brand new book that I published in 2017. And most people are giving up on an idea before an idea's got a chance to be able to reach maturity. And the beautiful thing about owning your IP is you can keep crafting it. You can keep shaping it. You can keep molding it. It's like it's clay.
Yeah.
Whereas if you sell it out to somebody else, it's crystallized in stone.
Yeah.
And now it cannot change. And as you change, you fall out of love with your past body of work. And I take huge inspiration from the music industry. Mm. Like, you two are playing in Vegas right now at the Sphere, and Bono has to love singing with or without you, even though it was written at an entirely different chapter in his life.
Have you seen them in the Sphere?
Only on friends sharing the video clips with huge FOMO around.
It looks amazing.
Yeah, I want to go.
Yeah, me too. They just took a break because of F1.
Okay.
Because everyone's there this next weekend.
Hopefully they'll come back in.
Yeah, man.
But it's cool that people can still bring that amount of passion, that amount of innovation to something that was actually penned and crafted with a meaning and sentiment to it when that person was completely different. And I think for those of us that are creators, is you want to grow old with your work. You want to look back at the things that you did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and still feel proud about them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you sell it too early or you give it to the wrong people, you steal your own dream by taking the fast check.
That's really good. No, my mind is reeling with so many regrets.
Lessons. Let's call them lessons. Yeah. Lessons, not regrets. No. Just a little reframe there.
Do you ever republish books that you're like, okay, so a book in 2017, have you done like a reprinting in 2023 where you've changed things? Yeah. Or adjusted things?
Well, here's a little secret, is exactly what to say is the rewrite of my second book that was called Magic Words. I published the book called Magic Words on a bet. I was in a mastermind group where people talked about how hard it was to get published. I said, it's not hard today. You could publish yourself in about 2-3 weeks if you put your mind to it. They said, put your money where your mouth is. So 3 weeks later, I turned a book out. I turned a 2-page PDF that I delivered in a training the week prior into a book, called it Magic Words, published it to Kindle, maybe 2011, woke up the next morning or like the next Friday, and like a week later, we put it into KDP Select. We had 120,000 downloads. It was a 4,500 word PDF.
What's KDP Select?
That was Kindle self-publishing, upload your own document, plug and play, do it for free type setup. And it was at the early onslaught of that. Mm-hmm. So what it allowed is you could put your book for free for a 7-day window and Amazon would give it a little extra love. And clearly got introduced to a number of strangers because I didn't have 120,000 people on the list. And you know, the marketplace tells you what of your content is valuable. You don't get to decide, right? Mm-hmm. So Magic Words became a giveaway. It was a download on my website to be able to lead capture. I'd use it at the back end of events just for fun. And when I went through my geographic move to the US in 2017 from the UK, I thought I needed to publish a brand new book. And then went, you idiot, I've got this thing in my back catalog that is very well liked, very well loved, that I half-baked, that I put out without thoughtful thought. why don't I take that EP and produce it as an album and go back and do that properly? And exactly what to say was that. And then I retired Magic Words. Because I own the IP, guess what? I can pull it.
I can pull old
work and don't have to ask anybody's permission. So we just put it out of stock.
Yeah,
and now it semi disappears. Mm-hmm. So we're always rewriting and reproducing, and even that little book, I now have a certification program from it. I got 32 licensed partners that train on that body of work. We've built Train the Trainer material. We've turned a simple book that can be read cover to cover in 72 minutes into 4 defining principles. Those 4 principles now show up in Train the Trainer programs that are licensed inside organizations. Mm. It started as a sales book. It now shows up in relationship advice. It now shows up in the legal profession. It now shows up as a central reading for people that are script writing in the entertainment and arts industry. Mm. It's being utilized as a training framework inside medical profession to help people have complex conversations around bad news with people going through medical difficulties, etc., to be able to help communicate in those family environments. It could even be used to help people stop the noise in the background here as we're recording the show, right? It could be used for all those reasons. What's happened is when you produce a piece of work that is so distilled, you can then do so much more with it. It's like producing a great spirit. It can then be used for incredible quantity of a never-ending quantity of cocktails. That's what I try to do with my work, is you can distill it down, then give it away and have other people add essence to it. Mm. That means, you know, the heart of it stays the same, but the combinations are never-ending.
Yeah, I just love this. And I'm just thinking there's people listening right now going, I just need to do something. Because I think people are so oftentimes filled with self-made excuses.
Easy to find a reason not to do something.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's, and all you have to do to do something is just do it. which is wonderful.
And sometimes look at it and say, well, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
And I believe that people land on one of two sides of self-talk. They either have an obnoxious level of optimism that actually is frightening, like blind naivety, which is great when you're younger in life, when you've got fewer risks to be able to, or they just have a negative self-talk that procrastinates and prevents them from being able to take action. The safe place in the middle of those two things is useful truth. Mm-hmm. If you can find some useful truth around where exactly you are, what exactly the opportunity looks like, who's done it before, do you have the means and capability, can you set three levels of success, that's like what's the worst that could happen and what am I really trying to do, and if I had a birthday what would it look like, then you actually give yourself permission to succeed at a level. Mm-hmm. And too many people see success as black or white. Mm-hmm. I produced a children's book around exactly what to say, which I adore, and people said to me like has it been successful? Like, heck yes. They're like, has it sold as many as the paperback? I'm like, no, nowhere near. I said, well, how has it been successful? I said, well, I decided that my first level of success was to be able to produce one copy of that book and be able to sit and read it with my toddler twins. That was winning. So what have I then had in the middle of that? Well, we've sold a few thousand copies. I've had a chance to be able to go into schools. I've used it as a tool to be able to help people navigate the complexities of understanding what comes out of their mouth, and everything's helping or hurting and nothing is neutral. And I'm still leaving space for the fact that one day, like Oprah or somebody will grab the children's book and decide that this now needs to fit be in everybody's Christmas stocking, or it now needs to become a guiding light for curriculum for teachers across the planet. Like, we're nowhere near that, but I'm going to hold space for it. I'm not saying it's not going to happen.
And it's only possible if you create it.
Correct.
Yeah.
So good.
But giving yourself the play space that winning isn't black or white, winning is gray. And if you can live in the gray, you can never have a finish line, which is actually joyful. Is if you decide that you're playing a game that never ends, you enjoy the play.
Yeah, when you read, you know, as a writer, you realize what is it? 85% of books never sell more than 5,000 copies. Right. And if you sell more than 5,000, you're in such a small group of people. And then I think if you sell more than 10,000, you're in an elite group.
Yep.
And, you know, I, we think about, oh, well, this book wasn't successful. And then you sold, you know, 50,000 copies. You're doing so much better than someone who's still aspiring for that.
Right.
And yeah, so it, you have to give yourself room. If you don't write it, no one reads it.
Well, and people don't care about the book. They care about the idea. And and Mindshift is an example of that, right? Is what's between the cover of that book is a number of proven methods and stories and examples of how people can do more with what happens up here to achieve more with what happens out there. Like, the book does that. But you don't care about the book. You care about people having a Mindshift. That's different. And I think many authors care about trying to sell the book as opposed to transfer the ideas.
Yeah.
If you care about transferring the ideas, you don't mind whether somebody met you and learned from them, came to an event, listened to you be able to speak, got concepts from a podcast, found them through an article that you've written. You don't care. But like, when people say, well, how do I understand more about this? The book happens to be one of the most condensed, portable, easy to access versions of a complete answer to that question. But you can't just care about shifting the book.
Yeah.
You have to market the message, not the modality.
Yeah.
That's what makes it never ending.
That's so good. All right. You have a meticulous ability to use words with incredible precision.
Thank you.
You're not a grenade. You are definitely like a sharpshooter.
With a lot of guns.
Not a lot of bullets.
An arsenal.
And, you know, listening to some of your own journey and your experience, you did a lot of sales.
Correct.
But somewhere in there, you became a wordsmith.
Right.
When did you realize the power of words, that this was going to be something you're going to make an art form for you, a craft?
I learned very early, even when you go back to like my childhood and the car washing piece and the what we did with landscape gardening, etc. I learned that your success in life is dependent upon your ability to ask thoughtful and meaningful questions. And one of the biggest reasons that people fail to get the change they're looking for in their life is because they're just not asking for it. They're wishing, waiting, hoping, and praying for something that they should be asking for. Then when I found myself in senior leadership positions at a very young age, I faced a lot of age prejudice. You know, I was working into environments where the majority of the workforce I was leading was significantly older, had significantly longer tenure. Mm-hmm. I didn't get instant respect in those environments. And the fastest route for me to transfer information was, instead of advising Aaron to do something, I'd say that based on what I understand about you, Aaron, some of the things you're looking to work on are blank, blank, and blank. And in terms of performance in this organization, is Erwin's got a leveled up performance in those areas. And there are three things that I've noticed that Erwin does that you don't do. Would it be helpful if you understood what those things were? So I'd always be looking to lead others through high performance. So never to deliver direct advice is look for people who are delivering exceptional levels of performance in an area I knew you were working on, and just be the messenger of translating that. So I became—
That is brilliant. It is.
It just oozes from you.
No, I just feel like we have to have a pause. It's the moment of silence after you see the nuclear bomb drop. There's just something really powerful. That's just so insightful. How did you figure that out at such a young age?
Because it's efficient. And it's universal, and you can't lose. Is so many people try to play to win, and they try to play to be right as opposed to get the right result. And anytime I'd find myself arguing with somebody to try and change a behavior or change an action, is even when I won, I would lose. So I'm like, this is a stupid game. Instead, why can't I focus every conversation on what does winning look like for both of us here right now? And this third-party messenger of being able to create posters of possibility through other people just became a go-to leadership style because it worked so well. What I found by taking that route is everybody I was looking at that was super successful, i.e. had high levels of competence but with consistency, the one thing that they did on repeat more than anybody else is they had efficiency in their word tracks. Like the moments that mattered in their measurements of success, they could reach for similar sequences of words every single time they needed them. Just, I would imagine, like a skilled carpenter knows exactly how to be able to do something that other people would find difficult because they've done it repetitively that number of times, that something that is impossible to others is effortless to them because they've built systems and processes. What I then find is that those language tracks would also then show repetition on each other. This just fascinated me, is that you'd see that a way that a leader would help somebody realize that their behavior was being obnoxious would be very similar to the way that a sales professional would help a customer realize that they should probably buy this and not that. And they'd create curiosity gaps. They'd help people second guess themselves. They'd put mirrors up in front of other people's actions by asking skillful questions to take a beat, to allow people to be able to self-evaluate, self-correct. Like, I believe you cannot change anybody else's mind on anything. You can only change their perspective. And if you can change the perspective that they're looking at something from, they may go on to change their own mind. The only way you can change somebody's perspective is to ask them a question to realize that the way they're currently looking at something might not be right. Not that it's wrong, it might not be right. Even simple questions like, how certain are you that what you believe is true is actually true? Well, until a second ago, I was pretty darn sure. And the creation of doubt gives you the ability to create change.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, this is an obsession.
Yeah. When I hear you talk about words, I don't know why, but this memory came to my mind when my brother and I were early 20s. We worked in an orange grove for one day because we were fired that night. But the manager fired us in the kindest way. He filled our car with gas and he said, "Don't come back tomorrow. You can't afford to work here." and we were climbing the orange trees and we didn't know they had thorns. We didn't know orange trees had thorns. And so we're getting ripped to shreds. We're bleeding everywhere, pulling oranges off. And there was this old, old man. I mean, he looked like he was 100. And he was just sitting in a lounge chair with a fishing pole he had rigged, and he would just and he'd strip all the oranges and they would drop into the crates. And we never saw him stand just the whole day. And his crates were just jam packed. Between me and my brother, we only had one crate. And I feel
you were like quite literally the worst migrant workers that ever existed.
And, he was just this very, very elderly, very thin African-American man who had this really dapper hat and looked like he was just chilling for the day. Yep. And he watched us and he just kept laughing at us all day long. Right. I think a lot of people use the words the way that we picked oranges.
Right.
And I think you use words the way that little old man did.
And it's precision. Like my dad taught me something really cool. And I said my dad's a self-employed builder and very much purposefully kept his business small. Roof repairs, simple extensions, you know, work with his hands forever and not afraid to get his hands dirty. And I remember working with my dad, maybe I was 13, 14, and going out looking to earn some wages to be able to help my dad one day. And he had a job to do on the way home from work that was just a roof repair in sort. Somebody had a problem with a leak on their roof, and everybody else that had out had said that the roof needs to be fully stripped off, fully redone. You need a new roof, tens of thousands of pounds. And they asked my dad to look at it as a second opinion or third opinion, wherever it might be. And he said, well, I'll go up and take a look at it right now. And he pulled the ladder off the back of his van and went up on the roof, came back down maybe 12, 15 minutes later and said, I fixed it for you. It's done. It's taken care of. They said, what do you mean it's done? He said, it's done. It's taken care of. Your roof won't leak for another 10 years. And they're like, what do you mean? Everybody else has said it's a new roof. And he said, no, it's taken care of. They said, what do I owe you? And I think he said, you know, £250 or £500, like something that to the individual sounded like a significant sum of money, actually. Oh, is they're really? Like, well, you're only up there 10 minutes. What did you do up there that made it worth that? He said, I stopped your roof from leaking.
Interesting.
And it became this almost standoff between dad and the customer, that they didn't see that amount of time was worth that amount of money. And he said, well, your other option is that you could have the roof completely replaced by what everybody else is saying. And he said, sometimes you've got to understand that the value comes from somebody knowing where to look for the leak and knowing what could be the cause. And yes, I used £3 worth of materials and it took me 10 minutes, but it's taken me over 35 years of understanding this profession to know what to do with that. And that, like, that story example has lived with me forever, is to be like, there is no substitute for experience and knowledge and wisdom. And the quest for wisdom is inspired me, and people that are wise are happy to share it with you. If you take the time to sit with them to let it come out. And
I think it's hard for people to understand that at the highest level, you don't pay for someone's time, you pay for their expertise.
That's right.
And then when we make that shift in life, it changes everything.
Hugely.
Right.
Because then you have a different viewpoint on how you choose to spend your own time, right?
That's right.
Is you no longer are thinking about spending money. You're thinking about the seconds and the minutes and the moments that show up in days. That's the currency you trade.
Yeah. There are a lot of roofs that you're fixing right now. A lot of leaks have stopped.
I thought that was going in the other direction. Right. It's like, oh, it's nothing compared to a complete roof.
No, but it's perception, right? Is people think that a big shift requires big work and big effort. And I think to that same degree is there are people that are sat listening to this right now that believe the change they're looking for in their life is monumental, it's significant, it requires massive money, it requires external investment, it requires time that they don't have at this period of time, so they keep putting it off, because they believe that change is a bigger thing than they've actually realized. And it could just be like this moment. Could be in the next 5 seconds of listening to this right now, they can make a choice or a change or a decision that goes on to change the rest of their life. And it's knowing which voice to listen to. And we all have lots of them going on up here, right? It's which one do you trust?
Yeah, it's the difference between 5 years of therapy and one choice that's been waiting to be made.
That's it.
That could change everything.
We all know many versions of the right things we should be doing that we're not doing.
Yeah. Now, I think sometimes it just takes time to find why that roof isn't fixed. And I think that's a part of it. And that's why it's really helpful to have people who have experience or have wisdom or have expertise to be able to look at our lives even. Mm-hmm. You know, when I work with, it's funny, I work with people who are so extraordinary what they do, and they're better what they do than I'll ever be.
Right.
But I can come in 30 minutes and help them see things they didn't see.
That's it.
And I know it's true for me too. Like, you know, someone can come into my life, and I mean, Aaron will see things in me and identify them and speak into my life. It irritate me, but it fixed the leak really fast.
But you need that, right?
Yeah.
And the second that you can own that about yourself, and you can say, mm-hmm. well, actually, that 2 + 2 = 5.
Yeah.
Is that an acceptance that says I'm putting the trust in somebody else to see things for me that I cannot see for myself.
Yeah.
You can create 2 + 2 = 5, 2 + 2 = 5, 2 + 2 = 5, and no longer feel alone. Is you can realize that other people are better at their job even in your life. Mm-hmm. And you can borrow their voices for things that you don't have the strength for.
Mm-hmm. That's so good.
I'm a roofer, but only for his roof. You can only see his roof. It's such an interesting concept. And you grew up with a lot of self-belief. You had this innate, it seems like you had the singular voice inside of you telling you could do this. Why not someone else? I can do this.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say it was a self-belief. It was a self-curiosity. It was like, what would it take to do stuff? I was
I love
obnoxiously
that.
Curious. It's like, I got to find out. Not that I can, but I know that I can find out.
Mm-hmm. So that's where it started.
Yep.
I know that I can find out.
Yeah.
And then were there moments where you found out that it just didn't work?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
still now. Like, you look at what does it take to be able to do things, and then you make decisions as to whether you want to be able to do that. And I was very early onto social media from a business point of view, and we met Facebook Live and Facebook groups in 2010, 2011. Mm. I had a paid for coaching community in a Facebook group that started because I did a monthly challenge that we called like Magic Months of Marvelous Mayhem. It was like 9 M's, etc. And it was £31 a month to join this challenge. It was £1 a day for 31 days for people to join. And we had like 3,500 people join really quickly. It was never meant to be that. And then we were supposed to go via a daily webinar on GoToWebinar, and the software just failed on the day of. I'm like, how on earth do I do this? Mm. And we were familiar with Facebook, and we use Facebook groups inside our small business from a communication and a, like people use Slack right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, why don't we just like tell everybody right now we're starting a Facebook group, and we're bringing everybody into a Facebook group, and we're going to go live in the Facebook group. Mm. This was like the newest thing ever that was happening at that time. And it worked. What then happened was day 15, day 16, day 17, people are like, what happens at the end of the month? They're already getting FOMO, what's next? So I said, well, why don't we make it a recurring monthly thing? Let's create a subscription model. Like 2,800, 2,900 decide that they want to be able to stick with this thing for a while. And it's a nice revenue, nice business model, nice offering. Other than the fact that I'm going live every single day without fail. And wherever I am, whatever's happening from a travel point of view, is this from my phone? Am I on vacation with my family? Like, where are we? I got to care about this. We were in part of this, and we were, before my wife and I were married, we were traveling Pacific Coast Highway and doing some cool stuff out on the West Coast here in the US. But the time I'd committed to go live every day was an East Coast time. So now I'm getting up at 4 a.m. on my vacation to try and find Wi-Fi out on the West Coast to go live on a video in the freaking dark. And 6-7 months into this thing, I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't like it. I went to Starbucks at 5 in the morning. I went into my Stripe account with all of my subscriptions. I canceled every £31 a month manually.
Wow.
And then I went live the next day. I'm like, this is it. This is the last one. You guys are ready. I'm graduating all of you. Here's your cap. Like, you ready?
Yeah.
Because what was happening is people were showing up for the content, not the action around the content. Is I was creating fans, not people going to create change in the world. Like, the reason behind me wanting to be able to do that in the first place was not congruent with the outcome that I was achieving. And then that became an example of, I now know what it takes to build a massive following on social. I know what it takes to be able to create content that builds you a fan base, but it helped me realize that what I don't want is fans. So therefore that action was a conscious decision that said, I now completely at peace that I don't have to have massive following, like completely at peace. Because what I'm looking to be able to work with is this number of people that make this much action as opposed to this number of people that do this much action. And you learn that through experience. So there are always examples of stuff that you learn through trial and error, you learn through, and it's not about what's right, it's about what's right for you. Because the model of being able to create massive audience is proven to deliver levels of success for many and continue to do so on repeat. It just didn't work for me. But it was an early example of saying, what would it take to create a subscription community? What would it take to be able to create armies of fans who tell you you're brilliant and write your letters about your awesomeness? And I didn't like it. It didn't bring me joy. It didn't make me feel whole. In fact, it made me feel weak.
In what way?
I felt responsible for things that I didn't have control over. That didn't feel like a position of strength. That actually felt like a position of vulnerability, and it felt less than congruent with the outcomes that I had promised as the reason why I wanted to start the thing in the first place. I felt like instead of delivering value that would inspire action and change, I was the distraction to the action. And that was in direct opposition to the goals and objectives of being in this line of work in the first place. And I think the second that your actions don't meet your beliefs, you end up not feeling committed to the cause anymore. In a sales environment, it's often been taught that people say that the first thing you need to sell is yourself. And I don't disagree with that, but I think prior to that, you have to be sold yourself. You have to believe that the thing you're asking somebody to do, to act upon, to exchange money for is worth it and some. And if you don't believe that the promise you're making to others is a promise that you can overfulfill, don't expect them to. So there's been many examples where I've just learned enough to say, I don't want that. And I've learned through mastermind groups and mentoring and situations that I've put myself in rooms with in the speaking profession, I've found more examples of negative role models. Not because that person is doing anything wrong, but they've just shown me an example that is 10 or 20, 30 years into my future where I'm like, not that. No, thank you. And therefore, instead of holding single people on pedestals, I build mentors out of creation of my own Frankenstein's monster. You know, I want the heart of this person and the head of this person and the work ethic of this person, the creativity of this person, and allow those to change depending upon what's needed, and then don't get let down. It's like tangent random, but...
No, that's good. I'm going to take a hard left turn here and ask you a very unexpected question, I think. Good. All right, with your awareness of language and the power of words and importance of clarity, how does that work in your marriage? How, you know, and I've been married 40 years, and you know, communicating to a person that you're that close to for that many years, ironically, is one of the greatest challenges in the world, I think. And can you share with me a little bit about how does that play out in your own relationships?
You know, it's always hard to talk about your relationship publicly when the other person in that relationship is not in the same conversation.
You can speak highly of yourself on her behalf.
and I agree with you, is marriage and all long-term relationships are very, very challenging. Where I think it helps the most is... actually in areas that maybe not the first thought that you jump to. So people, when they think about like, how does this work in your marriage, jump straight to conflict and dispute and negotiations and arguments and the things that are all relatively commonplace when you coexist with somebody day in, day out. The greatest area, I think, what I've learned with language has allowed us to be able to do in our marriage is to continually get realigned so that we can grow together. By which I mean, making big decisions about where do we want to live, what do we want to do for work, how do we want to bring our kids up, is to be able to slow down and have very rational debate and constructive conversation about what we do want as opposed to heated argument about what we don't want. That's been a huge gift. And I think one of the ways that, you know, my wife and I have gone from her being a actress, performer, dancer, model in Los Angeles, thinking that she wanted that chapter of life, and me being a kid from the outskirts of London that wanted more for himself but didn't know what that looked like, to us now building a real life in New York City together with, you know, our kids in a great community and a new group of friends, and actually feel like we're living bonus levels of a life that we never believed was possible when we first met each other. I think we've managed to do that because we can get aligned on values and goals and work puzzles out together. The alternative side of that is when things can get challenging or you can find yourself in moments that are heated or in debate, it doesn't feel like a fair fight. So the result of which is that because I'm a skilled negotiator, because there is a known entity that this is what I do for my work, this is what I do for my profession, I can't go into a fight with it being a fair fight. And everybody knows that. So what you end up with is you end up having to decide not to play sometimes. You end up having to say, I'm not going there because, and you just have to accept that sometimes somebody wants to just vent, somebody wants to exhale, somebody wants to emote. And not everything needs fixing. And that's a lesson I have to keep relearning because the coach in me and the obnoxious critic, but with the objective of making things better in all that I do, doesn't always need to show up in my marriage. Like that version of me, it's okay to leave that at work.
Yeah.
It's okay to leave that at the office. And that's something I'm continuing to work on.
Yeah, my wife Kim is in Orlando right now because my mom just had surgery for cancer. And I'm here working and I'm on my way there tonight. But my wife was so gracious, she flew early to spend those days with my mom. And I called her yesterday and she was exhausted. She had not slept in several days. She's sleeping in the hospital with my mom. And I said something and she just started, you know, yelling at me.
And my mom's Irish. Yelling is like other love.
I've met her.
My wife is Irish.
She's the best.
She's very, and then she called me later and she said, I want to apologize. I said, you have nothing to apologize for. You got up across the country. You haven't slept in days. You've been taking care of my mom.
Right.
And you can yell all you want. Because I knew she wasn't mad at me.
Right. So then she called me.
I think sometimes in marriage, we think that we're supposed to bring clarity to the argument.
Right. Yeah. It's sometimes that scenario of that there is no argument. And you know, to everybody listening in right now is there this scrappy, messy stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's not perfect. And my work from a language point of view requires firstly understanding that the worst time to think about the thing you're going to say is in the moment you're saying it.
Yeah.
Which is very much focused on repetitive conversations, known environments, known situations you're stepping into. That's actually where my superpower exists. It's the situations you knew you needed to get ready for. In marriage, there are thousands of moments that come up that, like, there's no prep. Right? This is be ready for unknowns, and that's okay, right?
Yeah.
I think sometimes the collective things to be able to get back to is to try to find a North Star that is a known truth, that regardless of how hostile or how challenging a conversation can you find something you agree on before you get into the debate?
Now, how old are your twins?
4.5.
All right.
So they're 5 in March.
All right. So tell me, they're in that wonderful developmental stage.
Yes.
And where they only know command.
Oh, they know a lot more than just command. They know I want. They know she said. They know I want. They know lots.
Yeah. And what have you found that has maybe surprised you or been insightful as a parent raising your kids and having conversations with them? Being a negotiator.
Yeah.
Now you're negotiating with the best negotiators in the world.
The very best. The very best. Kids are intuitive. Kids are smart. Mm-hmm. Kids understand what's going on. Twins is like a very special science experiment. Because I have identical twin girls that are largely the same DNA, that environmentally have somewhere near as close as possible the exact same existence day to day, yet are demonstrably different people.
Wow.
Right.
Different personas, different preferences, different behavioral styles, different sleep patterns, different even tones of voice, different. Yet the world wants to see them as the same. So they have a challenge as twins that even what society does is they call them the twins. How are the girls doing? And it's the hardest thing in the world for a parent of twins to have to continually fight the battle of saying, no, they're two people. They're two people. Yeah. People say, how are the twins? I say, you mean Kensington and Violet. Like we have to keep separating them because society wants to stick them together.
And their names are?
Kensington and Violet.
Violet?
Yeah.
And Kensington.
So what do I learn from that is I learn how quick people change. Mm-hmm. Like, because I travel as much as what I do with work is I don't get the joy of being a parent to any of my children as much as I would like to be. Hmm. And I believe that I provide inspiration and aspiration and open up doors of possibility for them because I'm not there all the time. I don't believe it's all a bad thing, but on a selfish level, I don't get to see my little girls grow every single day. What I get is the gift of not being able to see them grow every day is I get to see the leaps. So I get to see the difference between them on a Monday versus the next Sunday. And that leap can be profound. Mm-hmm. And the challenge we have in parenting is my wife wants to sometimes say is that they, you know, that she's this. Where I have to then sometimes remind, no, she's four.
Yeah.
And the way she is today is not the same way she was 6 months ago. It's not the same way that she was 6 months prior to that. Mm-hmm. So actually what they are is that they are living, breathing creatures that are growing and evolving. And the people that are responsible for shaping that are us as parents. And sometimes a tough responsibility to be able to take on board. So what do I learn is I'm repeatedly taught the lesson of you have to slow the process down to speed the outcome up. And when you have two children at the exact same time that are in a moment of despair, there is nothing you can do as a single adult to be there to create either a learning moment of aggression or discipline or a loving moment of compassion and care when there's one of you and two of them. So the only thing you can do is to slow the moment down in its entirety to help everybody find a new level of context that says, hold on, where are we at? Nobody's hurt. What's really going on at this point in time? To actually create some calm motion before you create next step. And seeing the need for that in a parenting capacity is then just echoed into every other area of my life is that what it's taught me is that before jumping to conclusion, before triggering action, before looking to try and put a label on something, can we slow the process down before we take action and know that actually that's likely to create a better action and get to the outcome we're looking for quicker? Kids have taught me that, even though I already knew it. Mm-hmm. It taught me it like right here.
Yeah.
Right here, because I cannot hug them both at the same time. I cannot kiss them both at the same time. I cannot demand them to both sit in the same corner. You can't. Yeah. So you gotta find a different playbook, and twins are a test beyond compare.
I love that. No, what a great description. All right. You have a brand new book.
From 2017.
Exactly what to say.
That's right.
I do love that language. I'm going to use that forever.
When you were writing the book, which before was called Magic.
Magic Words.
Magic Words. What was the problem you were trying to solve?
Initially, where it goes way back to is much of my work has been helping people develop sales skills that didn't see themselves as salespeople. So that would be customer service departments dealing with complaints or challenges or pushback from customers. It would be entrepreneurial professionals that were good at a thing but weren't good at selling themselves for that thing, weren't being rewarded at the right level for that thing. So what I decided to be able to do even very early in my career is to not call sales, is to help people understand principles around influence and persuasion. And then I tried to teach people principles around influence and persuasion, and it was too much for them. Trying to talk to them about neuroscience and, you know, the way that people think and how that leads to actions and behaviors. And I was fascinated about this stuff, but you know what most people would say? Just tell me exactly what to say. That's what they would ask.
That's me and him every day. Tell me exactly what to do and what to say, and I'll go and execute.
That's right.
You just read his soul script.
Yeah. So that's what kept coming back. And I'm like, oh, if I want to teach people principles, I have to give them examples. If I give them examples, they trip over principles. They learn the principle through the repetitive use of the examples. So magic words became the, let me share with you 17 sequences of words to allow you to persuade and influence more easily, more simply. It would show up in every area of my world. So my goal was to be able to take this much knowledge and wisdom around persuasion and influence, and can I put it on two sides of 8.5 by 11 paper and give you a quantity of examples, relate those examples towards the real life. And what I learned is that this 17 sequences of words, I could speak to any group of 15 people. I could craft examples on the spot for them and show them how they could use them in their day-to-day, and it would add efficacy and efficiency to what it was that they were doing. And they'd be like, "Pff, that blows my mind. You can do my job better than I can, and you don't know what my job is." So what I was looking to be able to do, what I was trying to help people with, was to realize the possibility of what they could do with language by delivering them fast examples that covered a lot of ground that were particularly prevalent with universal appeal. It was only meant to be a back of room giveaway. It was only meant to be the sprinkling on top of the cupcake. Was ended up being my life's work. And I'll use the musician's metaphor again. Is Elton John didn't decide what his greatest hits were. What he did is put out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of music, and the audience taught him what his greatest hits were. And I think as creators, that's what we have to listen to sometimes, is to say, well, let the success leave the clues. The marketplace decides where the magic is, you don't. And then when you get a clue, follow it. Don't try to fight against it. And what it's now become is, I'm very happy that my life's work could be, you know, loving father, proud husband, and creator of exactly what to say. That'll do. I'm at peace with that. And I don't see Rick Astley trying to work on new music. Right? He's never going to give you up.
Do you see Rick anywhere?
Yeah, you actually see him everywhere. I mean, he headlined Glastonbury last year. So just for context. Like, headlined Glastonbury because of a reputation that was built on a single song that has been reborn and reborn and redressed and recreated, etc. Is it the fact that it feels like a joke is actually huge testimony to the to the quantity of the staying power of that body of work. And like, I love those kind of one-hit wonders that when you dig into the story, they ain't one-hit wonders. They are remarkably talented individuals. They just were happy to accept the grace that was given to them, that you got, you're going to be known by the world for this one thing. Stop trying to fight against it.
Yeah, they finally hit, and everyone wonders why.
Right.
But it's because they have a body of work that led up to the one hit.
That's right.
So what do you, but I kind of believe you. What are you excited about next? Because I think you have a lot more in you.
Oh, I'm not giving up on anything. I'm going for a long, long time. But my goal is to help the message around exactly what to say find new marketplaces, is to empower new messengers to carry it to alternative marketplaces. I'm so proud of what we've created with the condensed material around exactly what to say that I can confidently give it away without fear of IP infringement, etc. We've sold nearly 3 million copies of the book. Next goal is 10. And that's going to take more time. That's going to be finding new audiences. That's going to be about me opening up my mind to alternative applications for where that can work and show up, and getting into that mess and trying to be able to recraft it. So we're not moving away from the principles of exactly what to say, but I'll share what they are. And I think this is where I'm looking to be able to do more work is, we believe that the worst time to think about the thing you're going to say is in the moment you're saying it. So if I'm going to help people get more prepared and add more intentionality for the known moments that are showing up in their life, and have them realize that it isn't a superpower to be able to wing it. It isn't a superpower to be able to respond in a moment and be quick-witted. It's a superpower to understand the moments that you're going to step into and put some thoughtful thought into them ahead of time, because you're responsible for that other person's actions that come from there. That belief is going to take me a lifetime to hammer home with the intent that I'd like to. We also believe that curiosity is the fuel to great conversation. I don't believe there is a problem in the world that couldn't have been helped or solved if somebody didn't just stop for a second and use a touch more strategic curiosity before they jump to a conclusion. Mm. Like, the world would be better if people were more strategically curious, if people could ask more insightful questions, if before somebody gave a single piece of advice, they asked three more questions to check what they believe in about the advice themselves. And I'm going to bang that drum until I've got no more air left in my lungs. I believe that people do things for their reasons and not yours. Yet we still live in a world where people want to tell people what to do because it matters to me. Like, I can tell you what I think you should do, Erwin, for as long as I've got air in my lungs, and you will not connect with that until you decide it matters to you. Mm-hmm. Like, my opinion is irrelevant until you decide that my opinion is valuable. And I think we live in an advice-driven world where people believe that your advice is the gift. No, the gift is created by somebody saying, I value your advice. So unless you can say things like, because of the fact that you said, because of the fact that you said blank, blank, and blank, then for those reasons, you may want to consider blank, blank, and blank. You should give approximately zero advice. I'd challenge everybody listening into this conversation today. Could you live a day in your life without giving a single piece of advice? It sounds easy to do. It's really hard. Live a day of your life giving zero advice and watch how your world changes. Only offer consideration for the action that somebody else can do using their words against them. Never project own opinion and watch how it changes life. And the final thing we believe is the person who's asking the questions controls the conversation. And if I can teach more people to more skillfully ask questions, I believe the world will be better for it. So that's actually really my work. It's not promoting exactly what to say. It's helping people bring more intention to the conversations that they've decided that matters. It's introducing more strategic curiosity to the world. It's helping people realize that people do things for their reasons and not yours. So unlock the reasons that are important to others as opposed to project your own. And then empower people to ask better questions. I'll do that for the rest of my life.
I need to ask more questions. I told you to not wear shorts this morning. But I was right. But I was wrong in how I did it.
Yeah. Hey, do you like being uncomfortable, Dad?
Yeah.
That's the question, right?
Yeah.
No, I don't like being uncomfortable. Well, you might not want to wear those shorts. Have you thought about how those shorts might make you feel?
Have you thought about how outside might make you feel?
It was cold today in New York.
Right.
It was cold.
How familiar are you with the temperature here in November versus the temperature in California?
Oh, yeah. Well, I dressed like I was still in LA.
Yeah. Could it be possible that you're dressing perfectly for today if you're at home?
Yeah.
You're not at home.
We need an AI version of you. An AI, a chat bot where we can go.
I think he is the AI version of you.
We don't need Kim Kardashian AI. We need Phil Jones AI with do I rephrase, Dad, you're going to be cold outside.
Right.
No, I think yours is more like, what are you thinking?
Yeah, that's it. That's the question. Yeah. What are you thinking? Like, are you for real?
The magic words are, you will be cold.
You got to be effing kidding me. I did.
Well,
that sounds more like it. Sorry. Getting closer.
Yes, no. But if you hadn't changed your shorts, we wouldn't have met the artist in the lobby.
It's true.
Yeah.
We met an artist who unveiled his art for a 3 Michelin star restaurant here in New York.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And we just happened to be sitting, I was sitting in the chair waiting, talking with Austin, and I was like, oh, this guy has a cool vibe. And he had this huge piece of a tube, you know? And I was like, immediately I said, well, I wonder what's in the tube.
Okay.
And then he walks down and says hi to him. And I'm like, you're going to be cold. And then also, how do we know this guy?
It's because I was walking through a restaurant yesterday and he came up to me and he said, Erwin McManus.
But where did it start? It started with a question, right? You saw something that sparked a curiosity gap in your mind. Yeah. Yes. You said, I wonder what's in the tube. You asked that question out loud and it created a let's find out.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think the whole dynamic of not giving advice, like what went through my mind is I'd love to have a day where no one asked me for advice.
Okay.
That would be really wonderful.
And you could get there though.
Yeah.
Because you could not give it.
Oh, and I don't give advice a lot. And I'm very careful.
Yeah.
Because I found over a lifetime that if you sound like you're telling someone what to do, they will hold you responsible for the outcome.
That's it.
Right?
Which you're not prepared to take that responsibility.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm not prepared to take responsibility for the choice that you're asking me to tell you to do. Usually what I'll say to, you know, the closest I think for me is, let's look at where your choices will take you.
Right.
And then you have to decide which choice and which outcome you want, but you can't choose one choice with a different outcome.
Yeah. And you're helping people, you know, create a bigger context and a greater understanding of what the impact of those choices could make. But just helping them see the size of those decisions, right? That's all.
My understanding is that you do get brought into companies to give advice.
Yes.
So how many questions do you feel that you ask before you get to the point where you give advice?
Enough.
Are there different situations where you're able to maybe come to a conclusion sooner than others?
Well, what would be a situation that you're thinking about that could be relevant to this?
Even just the construct of, well, you talked about, introducing doubt helps create the opportunity for change.
That's right.
Right. So when you go in to talk to the customer service team,
right?
Was that problem brought to you? Customer service isn't up to par. We need to bring a change.
Yep.
How are you able to see that insight of they're so much more than customer service people? They're also salespeople.
Everybody's a salesperson in some way. They just need to realize the impact they have.
So it comes from like a set of core beliefs.
Yes. Rephrase the question for me because I'm not sure what you're asking.
How do you do what you do? Is it intuition or is it a set of data points based around the questions that you ask?
How does a chess master win a game of chess?
Well, some might say he cheats.
They might.
Was it the scandal that happened last year with like the vibration and the... Never mind. Sorry, that's dark. Did you hear about this whole thing?
Not so much.
Oh, okay.
Well, how does a morally competent chess player win a game of chess?
No, practice. Continual matches of chess.
Yes.
Studying.
And also the ability to play multiple moves at the same time. Mm-hmm. The ability to slow a situation down to say that actually I don't need to achieve the outcome that I'm looking for in one move. Hmm. I'm happy to be able to get there in 5, 6, 7, 8, 11, 15, 23, whatever it takes. Hmm. More often than not, in any given environment where you're being asked to consult, what they're looking for is your advice. Yet what they truly don't actually understand is the problem. Hmm. They think the problem is this, yet the problem is actually this over here. Mm-hmm. So the first job is to get them to realize that this is the problem. Hmm. Which means they're saying, I need your help with blank. So you say yes, but then you got to go figure out, like, what's actually this? Mm. And this is, I'm sure, very true in much of the work that you do, Owen, is you say yes to help this problem. Mm. And then you believe enough in your own skill set that you can get into the mess to understand what's really going on to help them see that it's over here. And let's take a customer service scenario where people are puzzled by, you know, hostile clients and how to deal with complaint situations and what to do to be able to diffuse a heated customer. They think that people need skills to diffuse arguments. What they really need is skills to prevent arguments, which is a completely different set of playbooks. So if I run through a series of questions with people, which was even something as simple as, when was the last time this happened for you? How often does that happen? For how long has that been an issue to you? Mm. What do you believe the other person might be thinking in that scenario? Mm. What are the potential consequences of not being able to resolve this? Where have there been scenarios where you've managed to be able to appease a situation like this well? Mm. Who else has actions that impacts that person being able to believe on that? What possible solutions could be created by others outside of you before this becomes a problem? Mm. When somebody gets themselves to that situation, is what is the first thing that you say right now? That first thing you say right now, do you think that helps or hinders that person's emotional response to what happens next? Or it doesn't help? Or could it be possible that maybe something needs to change further down the tracks, but also when something does land in your lap, that your initial response could be different to what it is right now? And they're like, yeah, I guess it could be. What could that look like, Phil? And I can be like, well, being as you've now asked, would it help if I shared with you some alternative ways that you could approach that hostile client to put yourself into a situation where not only you were controlled, but you could save time and that you could get them to a point of appeasement quicker? They're like, yeah, I'm up for that. Mm. They're like, well, what would that look like? I'm like, well, how long have you got? Mm. Like, everything's in questions, but what we're doing is we're preparing ourselves to get towards an outcome slowly. Mm. See, I don't mind getting into difficult conversations because I don't go into a difficult conversation with a predetermined outcome. Mm. I go into a difficult conversation understanding that I have the tools to achieve a meaningful outcome. Mm. I don't need to know what it is at the start. Mm. I need to know that I can help somebody get there. And I think that's a miss that many people have from negotiation, influence, and even coaching is you have to go in neutral. Mm-hmm. You have to go into a conversation knowing I don't know enough. That's the most important vantage point is you're asking for advice, but I don't know enough to give any advice at this period of time. Mm. I know enough to know that I don't know enough. Mm. That's how expert that you need to be in these scenarios. So then what you do, you're just building strategically curious questions until you get to a point of understanding. And in most sets of circumstances, if you can show somebody you understand their problem, they'll trust you with a solution.
Yeah. Mm.
Try sell somebody on your solution. They'll work to say that that's not the problem.
A huge part of the problem sometimes is you're brought into companies, at least my experiences, and they've misidentified the problem.
Almost always.
Yeah. And so they want you to solve a problem that isn't the problem that needs to be solved.
Correct.
So a huge part of the process is actually changing their whole perception of what the problem is.
Right.
And back to chess, by the way, when a person's a really good chess player, they control their moves, but when they're a great chess player, they control both players' moves.
Correct.
And questions are the way you control the other player's moves.
You're leading the dance, right?
Yeah.
People like to dance, but what they're often looking for is somebody to lead the dance.
Yeah.
Is nobody wants to be able to lead unless they're an experienced dancer.
Yeah. It's still blunt force trauma, but it's coming from the inside out, not the outside in. It's not you telling them something they need to hear. It's them being forced to acknowledge something they need to.
Right.
Admit they can see.
And it's something you do for somebody, not to somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a level of leadership that you say that I'm brave enough to get into this mess with you to help you see what's right for you. Yeah. Not because I'm trying to project my opinion or version of right on you. Mm. Mm.
So if you had one last thought you want to share with everyone, because I feel like we could just talk all day. And this is,
you are fantastic, by the way. I'm such a big fan of yours. I hope
thank you,
know.
My friend.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to read everything on sales that you have, because I'm such a bad salesperson. It's an amazing gift.
I think a cool thing for you to plug into if you're keen to explore sales in a different way is I got the gift of being invited by Audible to do a one-man show here off Broadway. And I produced a full-day sales training program called How to Persuade and Get Paid. And it was produced for the Audible listener. So it lives as an Audible original, you know, like a comedian gets a Netflix original. I got an Audible original. And
how do we access that?
For the cost of an Audible credit, or if you're an Audible membership at a certain level, it's for nothing. But, you know, it lives in that sort of dark corner of Audible.
So I just go to my Audible,
hit Phil M. Jones, and How to Persuade and Get Paid is you get a seat in a full-day sales training program for an Audible credit.
And that's amazing, done.
It's huge, and it's probably one of my greatest pieces of work that sits in that undiscovered spot because of the fact that I sold it to one company with one set of rights around it and have no control about it.
So you have done that.
Yeah, exactly, with regret. But I love how accessible it can be. So now even the one-day training program that I once upon a time sold for £85 a ticket and struggled is I sold once to Audible for a six-figure check and delivered in one day. It's largely the same content, and I had a live audience. But we produced that program where it's not the recording of a live show. We recorded that program that the primary listener is the person with earbuds in their ear listening on Audible that happens to also have other people in the conference. So the feeling should be that you're an active participant in a workshop. You just don't get asked questions too often personally. So I love that, and I think it reframes what people think about selling. And as we sit here in 2023 in this discussion, is there are lots and lots and lots of people that think that the acquisition of more customers, or getting customers to pay more money for what you currently provide, or getting them to come back and buy from you again, requires fancy AI skills, requires the ability to market like Alex Hormozy, or requires you the ability to be able to build massive followings, etc., on social. And the raw human sales skills are missing in the majority of the current generation of business builders. So if I had a final thought, it would be, if you have an appetite for growing in any area of your life, whether that is growing your business, whether that's growing your personal influence, whether it's having a bigger impact in your community, whether it's finding the love of your life, whether it's being able to, you know, grow and create change with a community of others around the world, the missing skills are probably sales skills, and what you think are sales skills are probably not what are actually the sales skills you're missing. So get curious about how to get very, very good at identifying opportunity, creating opportunity, mastering opportunities that exist within the relationships that you've created. And I think how to persuade and get paid offers the answers to many of those questions in a hidden little corner of audible.com.
Wow.
I love it. We'll link that in the bio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
this
there.
Podcast.
Yeah. Absolutely. We're going to definitely get that out to people. Yeah.
And I get paid approximately $0 every time you download.
Yeah, that's we'll the only thing I hate about it.
We'll link something else then.
Yeah. That's no, the only thing I hate about
I honestly don't mind. I think it matters. And I think the three of us in this conversation and many people listening in is a very okay with the fact that the work you do today doesn't have to pay today. There doesn't have to be instant reward and gratification. And I'm 100% certain that if somebody takes that program, utilizes it, goes on to be able to build something significant in their life, that may well loop back to me at some point in time, and that could be 20 years, and I'm okay with that. Don't need to get paid today. I do plenty of things that I get paid for today because of work I did a decade ago. I can keep doing the same.
I love that.
I love it too.
Well, Phil, I hope this is just one of many conversations we have for
you
years
guys are
to come.
Awesome.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, man. I don't know exactly what to say, but thank you.
So many questions now. No, thank you so much, genuinely.
My pleasure.